a recording of the Robert Greenstein teleconference, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Tuesday, September 16th, 2014, scheduled for 1 p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our presenters in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we'll open the floor for questions. At that time, the procedure will be given if you would like to ask a question. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Robert Greenstein. Sir, please begin.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here with Jared Bernstein and a number of other analysts, poverty and health and income analysts here at the center. I'll make some remarks, and then Jared will, and then we will go quickly to your questions. I would just note before we start that we have posted on our website an overview statement about the data, a blog post looking more at the census health data. We are about to post shortly a closer look at the new health insurance data issued this morning by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and later in the day we will have more in-depth analysis of both the poverty and the health data. Jared, as he will mention, is also posting on his blog additional analysis, particularly on a number of the income and employment-related issues. As you all know, the Census Bureau released new data this morning. Those data provide fresh evidence that the economy strengthened in 2013, but too slowly to improve the living standards of many middle and low-income Americans. Let's remember that 2013 was the fourth full year of the economic recovery. The recession ended during 2009. Yet, median household income did not rise significantly and remained in 2013 8% or $4,500 below its level in 2007 before the Great Recession started, and even farther, 8.6% below its level in 2000 before the 2001 recession. As those data indicate, the 2001 to 2007 recovery did not perform well on these indicators either, a point to which I'll return shortly. Now, the poverty rate did fall from 15% in 2012 to 14.5% in 2013. That's the first statistically significant decline in the poverty rate since 2006 and only the second since 2000. In other words, the poverty rate has failed to improve in 11 of the last 13 years. But even with the improvement in the poverty rate, welcome as it is to 14.5% last year, that rate remains well above its 12.5% level in 2007, even farther above its 2000 level, which was 11.3%. Another way to look at this is that at the rate of improvement in 2013 in poverty, we would need to wait until 2018 for it to fall to or below the 2007 level, and until 2020 for it to fall below the 2000 level, and that's assuming there'd be no recession in the interim to interrupt the progress. Perhaps the best news in today's report is a substantial decline in poverty among children, from 21.8% in 2012 to 19.9% in 2013, although here too, that lower rate in 2013 still remains well above its 2000 and 2007 levels. The census data indicate that the child poverty drop in 2013 was driven largely by a rise in employment and earnings among parents. Indeed, median income among families with children rose in 2013, even as overall median income stagnated. Now, I mentioned earlier that the data aren't good on the 2001 to 2007 recovery either. There appears to be a larger trend at work here. In contrast with the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, when the benefits of economic recoveries were more broadly shared and poverty and median income improved more quickly when recovery started, the recoveries of the past two decades have been much slower to generate income gains for middle and lower income Americans. One part of the problem is the rising inequality of recent decades, which has meant that economic growth has not been widely shared by various census measures, inequality remained at or near record levels in 2013, with inequality essentially unchanged in statistical terms between 2012 and 2013. Another factor that held down improvements in middle and low income living standards last year was premature federal austerity policies, such as the sequestration cuts, which restrained economic growth. We often forget that the Congressional Budget Office projected that the changes in federal spending and tax policies that took effect in 2013 cost the economy more than 1 million jobs last year. Goldman Sachs estimates that the federal spending and tax policies that took effect in 2013, and this isn't just sequestration, this includes things like the expiration of the payroll tax cut as well. Goldman Sachs estimates they reduced economic growth by about 1.1% of gross domestic product last year. In retrospect, we'd have been wiser to invest more in infrastructure and things like education to put more people back to work in the short term, as well as to strengthen productivity and growth in the longer term. Now, if the child poverty is the brightest story, another bright story are the health care data. The share of Americans without health insurance fell slightly in 2013 based on the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, from 14.8 to 14.5% of Americans being without health insurance. But an array of other studies and data, including new data that CDC issued just this morning, show that the number of Americans without insurance has fallen markedly in 2014 with the implementation of health reform. The new CDC data shows a drop from 14.4% uninsured to 13.1% just in the first quarter of 2014. And of course, much of the enrollment surge in the new health insurance exchanges didn't really start with coverage until April, the second quarter. And when we look at an Urban Institute study that compares the third quarter of 2013 with the second quarter of 2014, we find a full 4 percentage point drop. That's quite big in the share of Americans who are uninsured. Now, there's one other really interesting factor in the health insurance front, I think. In the census data, the CDC data, the Urban Institute data, they're all showing it. And that is that the states that expanded Medicaid under health reform as compared to the states that didn't expand Medicaid. The states that didn't expand Medicaid had significantly higher uninsurance rates already in 2013. You might say they were really the states that needed the Medicaid expansion the most, but didn't take it. And the data are also showing much bigger drops in the uninsurance rates in the Medicaid expansion states than in the other states. So to give you a little bit of a feel, under the Urban Institute data, there was a 6 percentage point drop by the second quarter of 2014 in the share of people who were uninsured in the Medicaid expansion states, and less than a 2 percentage point drop in the other states. What that means when you put together these various facts, it means that the gap in health insurance coverage between these two groups of states is widening and is really getting very, very large. Under the Urban Institute data, the Medicaid expansion states in the second quarter of 2014 had a 10% uninsurance rate, whereas the states that refused the expansion had an uninsurance rate of over 18%, nearly twice as high. That's a really large gap between two groups of states. Finally, other interesting pieces of data emerge from the census figures released today. One, for example, I'll just mention one and then turn it over to Jared, and that is we have new data on the impact of SNAP, what we used to call food stamps, on poverty if you count it as income. Now, the official poverty measure doesn't count food stamps as income. The supplemental poverty measure that Census will release data on later this fall does count it as income. Most analysts believe it should count as income. In any event, today's census data shows that if you count SNAP as income, it lifted 3.7 million people, including 1.5 million children, out of poverty in 2013, indicating that the program is having a significant effect in reducing poverty and hardship at the bottom of the income scale. Let me turn it over to Jared.
Thank you. With the exception of the welcome and historically large decline in child poverty, today's report offers another data point in support of a discomforting new normal where economic recoveries take years to reach most households. The improving but still slack job market is at the key of many of the observations we've been making. Gains from work are important in the context of poverty and middle-class incomes, as anti-poverty policy increasingly depends on work. While the overall job market improved only moderately in 2013, today's report reveals that the number of full-time year-round workers was up by more than 6 million between 2010 and 2013. However, even these workers who are well-connected to the job market have seen flat real earnings in recent years. Median earnings for both men and women full-timers were statistically unchanged in 2013 and have been down for men a bit and flat for women over the recovery. In fact, men's median earnings were just about the same level last year as they were in 2000, about $50,000 in today's dollars. When the labor force is weak, there's little pressure that would force employers to bid wages up to get or keep the workers they need. For that reason, real wages across much of the economy have been trending flat in recent years, as nominal wage growth of around 2% has been about matched by inflation's similar pace. That implies that to the extent that working families got ahead, it was from more work at flat or lower real wages. I should say it was from more work at flat or lower real hourly wages. Another sign that working families are doing a bit better comes from the slightly favorable trend over the last few years among working age households. Their median income is up 1.4% in real terms over the past couple of years compared to no change for all households. Moreover, one reason child poverty fell last year was because among families with kids, the number with full-time, full-year workers was up last year, and the number without any workers was down. That said, these are relatively minor improvements, and the fact unquestionably remains that the economic recovery has not done much to lift the living standards of most poor and middle-income households. Clearly, growing inequality of economic outcomes is in play. The census data leave out some important income components that influence inequality, such as capital gains and the value of non-cash transfer programs like nutritional support, as Bob mentioned when he was talking about food stamps. Still, the data reveal inequality trends that are consistent with more comprehensive sources. Bob went through the numbers, so I won't. I'll just note that the shares of income accruing to the best-off households are near record highs. The top fifth held over half of all income last year, 51%, and almost half of that share, 22%, was held by the richest 5% of households. Of course, citing inequality is a factor in this persistent disconnect between overall growth and the well-being of poor and middle-class households just begs the question as to why economic growth has become such a spectator sport for so many households. Since working-age households typically depend on their paychecks as opposed to investment portfolios, as noted, the job market, still too slack, is a prime suspect. In that regard, I think today's report, while it suggests some employment gains for working families, the Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, they're currently meeting just down the street with the Open Market Committee, Fed Reserve Chair Yellen correctly emphasizes that the considerable slack remains and wage growth remains flat or worse for too many workers. In this regard, a key takeaway from today's report is that the economic challenge facing the middle class and the poor is at least twofold. First, the structure of the economy has made it harder for them to benefit from overall growth. Global competition, technological changes, barriers to education, deunionization, financial and housing bubbles, intractable recessions followed by first jobless and then wageless recoveries, the persistent absence of tight labor markets, all of these factors contribute to the growing disconnect between growth and the economic well-being of most households. Their second problem is that policymakers have not only failed to protect or adequately prepare the less advantaged for these developments, they've exacerbated their impact. In the near term, austere fiscal policy that shaved 1.5 percentage points off of growth last year, as Bob emphasized, is implicated in today's results. The expiration of the payroll tax holiday last year, for example, was a major factor in 2013's fiscal drag, and it directly reduced the earnings of millions of workers, yet few policymakers fought to preserve it. Same with extended UI benefits, though many congressional Democrats in the administration tried to preserve this important benefit in the face of such elevated long-term unemployment. Those are examples of near-term ways in which policymakers are hurting the prospects of working families. But over the longer term, we've seen attacks on the safety net, on social insurance, on investments in public goods, from roads and bridges to healthcare and education. It's as if at the same time the rising river of global competition and inequality were threatening those stuck in the floodplains, the town's engineers decided to ignore the eroding levees. Today's results provide further evidence that economic recoveries are taking much longer than in the past to reach the poor and middle class, and that reality poses a fundamental challenge that too many of today's policymakers are ignoring. If this is the new normal, expansions that for years leave most households behind, then broad swaths of Americans have every right to demand that policymakers stop their seemingly endless partisan squabbling and address the factors blocking shared prosperity.
Thank you, Jared. Operator, we're ready for questions.